Life insurance and qualified plans. Now, you'll notice the huge attendance that we get when it comes to the qualified plan area. This is an area that really attracts top producers, and there aren't that many of them. So wait till the people actually show up for this crazy thing. You know, and so the next less than hour, we're going to learn everything we need to know about qualified plans, why you do qualified plans, and why are speakers who don't recommend qualified plans, why they're 100% wrong. And I'll show you why, because it's pretty simple. Because first of all, I'll introduce myself. My name is Nick Palavita. I am a tax attorney. I've been practicing law for 34 years now, licensed before the Florida Bar, the U.S. Tax Court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court of the United States. And I have taken cases to every one of these wonderful jurisdictions over 34 years. I'm also CEO of National Pension Partners, where we've administered over 400 qualified plans. Most of them are fully insured plans, otherwise known as 412(e)(3) plans, that have life insurance and annuities inside of it. Lead faculty member for the graduate tax program at Northeastern University, where for 7 years I have been the lead faculty at Northeastern University in Boston, teaching the graduate tax program there. And also, I am the lead faculty member at Campbell University in Raleigh, where I teach the law school estate planning course. I also have a television show called Money Masters, which you can see. I gave little cards out. Moneymasters.tv. If you ever happen to go to that, that is scheduled to go on here in January. And those are interviews that we conduct with various interesting and wonderful people, such as John Fanning, the founder of Napster, John Sculley, who is the founder, not founder, he was a former CEO of Apple Computer, plus we have about five with the Federal Reserve up in Boston. We did a whole series with them, and we're shooting one with the IBM and Watson, otherwise known as called Startup Masters, and that starts in January of this year. But if you go to the website, you'll see a lot of the television shows we have already cut in this particular area. And then, of course, there's a lot of financial people on the television shows, too. David Walker, the former Comptroller General of the United States. It's been on our show many times, et cetera. So I do that. And I live in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. I don't live here. As a matter of fact, there's going to be another good speaker right after me, Dave Gresham, who comes from Indianapolis. All the good speakers are from somewhere else, and they come here. So you want to stay and see Dave. I saw him yesterday. What?
Be careful.
Okay, I'm just like, I talk, okay? Oh, you do? Okay, all right, Brett, you're okay. You're cool. You know, we don't mind you. All right, now, so the thing is, there's a lot of good people coming to the program. I do recommend that you stay for Dave's program. Now, the area I'm talking about is life insurance and qualified plans. This is a very niche market space that exists, and it's a very not understood market space. Now, after teaching the graduate tax program for 7 years now, we have a problem in the United States that most people aren't aware of, but I'll make you aware of real quickly. How many of you took a retirement plan class when you were in high school? Please raise your hand. No. Okay, college. You went to college, BYU. Do they even offer one? No. Okay. Law school, MBA school, medical school, dental school. Did you take one in law school?
MBA.
MBA. They offered one? A retirement plan class in MBA?
I don't know what
you had some exposure, but you never took a qualified plan class.
No.
Okay. That's because it's not offered. If you do your research and go to the internet and you look at these institutions such as Harvard, Yale, University of Chicago, Stanford, one thing I guarantee you get an MBA from those schools, you never took a retirement plan class. UCLA might offer one because USC has a very good tax program. Maybe it bleeds over to UCLA, maybe, at the graduate tax level, but not in the MBA level. So what we have is 318 million people in the United States, and most of them have taken this in retirement plans. They know very little about it. And there's two reasons. A, maybe we don't want you to know about it. B, maybe you don't want to know about it. There can be only two reasons. A, you don't want to know about it because it's too complicated. Well, I don't qualify, but well, let's go somewhere else. Or B, we don't want you to know about it because there's a lot of sophisticated things you could actually do in this area that people don't even know. And I'll go through a basic one I do in all the classes. All right. How many people heard of a 401k? Please, 401k, yes, right. Now you have a SEP IRA. How many heard of SEP IRAs? Right. What would you rather have and what's more tax efficient, a SEP IRA or a 401k? What's more tax efficient? Tax efficient. And why? Ding, do, 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 do. Put more in the SEP. SEP, you can. That could be one argument because SEPs have 25% of your pay to a maximum of $54,000. is the basic rule. And IRA and 401k is 100% of pay to 18,000 plus a top up of 6 equal 24. But here's the reason why your SEP or your pension, since you're from the Great Lafayette, the pension is more tax efficient. And same with the SEP, same with your profit sharing plan than your IRA, than your 401k because of this. Social Security and Medicare taxes. Follow the money, as one federal judge said, as I was in front of. Let's go take a look. You have $10,000 you want to put away from retirement. It goes to you first as salary deferral under 401k. 15.3% is taken out, 6.2 from you, 6.2 from your employer, 1.45 in Social Security and Medicare tax from you, and one for your employer. 15.3 is removed. Then the balance goes into your retirement plan. You lost 15.3% on every dollar that goes into your 401k. Now, how many people, when you are in 401k space, does your 401k guy come to you and say, "Hi, we have a 15.3% load. Did you know that?" No, they're crazy. They're trying to sell you a mutual fund. They're never going to say that. Now let's go to a pension or a SEP IRA. The money goes from the corporation on either line 17 or 23. You can check that out if it's a S or C corp. Onto your pension plan after it's deducted. Because it goes direct from the corporation to the plan, you pay no Social Security and Medicare taxes. You save 15.3% of every dollar that you put in to your pension or your profit sharing plan. This, everybody should know before you walk in this room. This is basic high school. Oh yeah, we all know that. 401ks are tax inefficient relative to pensions, profit sharings, and SEP IRAs. Yet reality, because I lecture before University of Denver Law School, I teach at Northeastern, I teach at Campbell, people don't know about that. It's because they never took a retirement planning class, yet it's basic. Even the people that say, well, you know, it's a big advantage to not to do these qualified plans. It's better just take the money and put it in an insurance policy. They're totally wrong. And here's the reason why. Most income is earned income. And when you have earned income, you're an EA. Do they pay taxes and Social Security income on earned income? Earned income, yes. So what they forget to put in their calculation is the 15.3% load. If you put it into a qualified plan that's a pension plan, do you pay the 15.3% load? No. And when you go to retire, do you pay it? No. It's completely eliminated. You can also eliminate your state income taxes the same way, because qualified plan money is deducted from state income tax, but you have to do one more thing. You must leave the state of Nevada, excuse me, the state of Utah, where you're paying 5%, and retire in Nevada, which you pay zero when it comes out. This play is very well known, that actually Forbes magazine published a whole article on it. So I thought, well, everybody knows this, right? You eliminate state income tax, Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, as long as you set up a qualified plan. In reality, very few people know about it. And they'll say, well, you shouldn't have a qualified plan. You just take the money and get it tax-free when you go to retire. Totally wrong, because they never factored those factors in to their mathematical equation, which is one reason you work with enrolled actuaries who do this type of work all the time, because they know this stuff. It's totally different. So now you know a little bit about the basics. And we're going to look at boosting benefits and qualified plans, the future of tax and asset protection planning. What you find out in the world of reality that's out there, clients are driven, especially the higher income taxes, about reducing their taxes. They don't want to hear about tax-free income when they're 79. They want to know about their tax deduction bloody today. And the qualified plan allows you to get them there, generally. Qualified plans have another advantage. If you're sued and you have assets in a qualified plan, can a creditor touch it? No. Can the bankruptcy creditor touch it? No. Does that apply to your house? No. Most of your house, actually, a bankruptcy creditor can take. You lose it. There are very few states, only Florida and Texas, you can keep your home. And most of them, and I haven't checked Utah, there's a limit as to the amount of home that you can keep. And how much is it? Oh, it's $45,000. So if you're sued in Utah, you get to keep the home at the value of $45,000. And we know in Utah, the value of equity of $45,000. We know in Utah, homes aren't worth more than $45,000 here, right? In other words, you can buy a home for $65,000, $35,000, right, on Zillow. Sure. I will tell you this in practice, because remember, I've done over 400 of these things. It's not like this. They won't do it because of the asset protection planning. They always do it because of this tax. High-income taxpayers are driven for tax deductions. And one place you can get it is the qualified plan. There's no question about it. The problem is very few people even know about the area that we're going to look at, is how you put life insurance in the qualified plan. and why you would put life insurance in a qualified plan. I would say that probably 80, 90% of our plans have death benefits in a qualified plan. Historically, it's been that way. People have life insurance in qualified plans. But why do you have life insurance in qualified plans? I have a doctor who's making $500,000 a year. Why would he buy life insurance in a qualified plan? Okay, let's look at the doctor. He's making $500,000 a year. He's married, has kids. He dies. He was in an auto accident. What happens to his income? He's making $500,000 a year. What happens when he dies? Where does his income go? Goes to where?
Zero.
Project his income over 10 years. Let's say he was able to work for 10 years. Okay? Are you telling me he just lost $5 million in potential income? He's making $500,000 bucks a year. All right. So wouldn't it be a good idea? Do you think the spouse who's living on, which I used to do, a $20,000 a month lifestyle? I don't know if you guys have ever had that. I call it the basic $20,000 a month lifestyle. All right. And my wife makes me carry insurance. She goes, well, we can't replace that if you die. Okay, I understand. I got it. Okay? You know, you need a certain amount of millions to replace the lifestyle. To replace a basic lifestyle of $215,000 a year takes $3,400,000. Seriously. So the first thing I look at when I see medical professionals or anybody in this, say, do you guys have 3.4 million death benefits? No. Do you have 3.4 million sitting in your bank account? No, you know, we have a million maybe. Said you'll never replace the $215,000 income. And that's not me doing the study. You can pull the study from the General Accounting Office that actually did a whole study on income replacements. Today in a low interest rate environment, you need 3.4 million. So I always look around when I see a professional is earning, you know, a decent amount of income, who's setting up a qualified plan, say, do you guys have 3.4 million in death benefits? No. Well, you die. Now what's the next story? Oh, my income's all gone. Okay, so how does your wife pay the bills? Remember, how do they pay the house, the four cars you have, the kids' private education? And when I add it up, you're spending $20,000 bucks a month. How are you going to pay for it? Well, we got a problem here, duh. So you want to buy the insurance. And there's two ways you can buy it. One, you can buy it outside the plan, not get the deduction. Remember, you're in a 50% bracket. Two, you can buy it inside the plan and deduct the whole thing. What would you rather do?
Yeah, but now the death benefit is paid to the plan.
And? Maybe. You have a choice. You could either take it taxable in the form of a lifetime income, or you can, what they call, re-include your income, the PS58 amount, now known as the Table 2001 rate, or the term rate of the insurance company, whichever is lower if you can ever find their AFR rates, which may be $6,000. So they get a $200,000 deduction, but they have to re-include $6,000, so their net deduction is $194,000. What's wrong with that? Now the net amount at risk death benefit comes out tax-free. By the way, this is a very interesting concept. This is one of the few ways today, legally, you can actually get money tax deductible going in and tax free coming out. You know what you have to do? You have to die while you're a participant in the plan. The other ways you can get it out tax free is 401H, which is beyond the scope of this conversation, but I will be doing it at the end of the program. It's one of my topics they're making me do. But those are ways you can actually get tax deductions going out legitimately and tax free money going out. Free coming out. One is dying while you're a participant in the plan. Most people don't elect to do that. Two is establishing a 401H account. And then you get certain benefits, usually post-retirement medical, to come out tax-free. And you have to understand how this crazy system is designed, otherwise called as ERISA, that makes this system work. Otherwise known as the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974 as amended. Work-life balance? Well, let me tell you something about this. If you're working with a high-income taxpayer, get rid of balance in life, because this is what they do. They work all the time. Your medical doctor is hard to get a hold of because they work 13 hours a day. You know, if you get their hour to meet with them, you're good. They don't have that thing called balance. They need to work on that. Perfect employee benefit, higher perceived value cost for the employer and employee allows the business owner to discriminate. And we're going to go over what they call permissible discrimination. One in a pension, which you can't get in your 401k profit sharing plan, is the older person gets to put more money in. And the highly comps get to put more money in. Because if you're age 60, you have to retire at age 65 under ERISA. The rule is age 62 to 65, 5 years participation, or age 60, you got 5 years to fund a balance that gives you $3,400,000. But if you read the rules carefully, you have to reduce the contribution 10% each year that you can't fund for 10 years. So it's really half the numbers. You cut all the numbers in half. And you make that contribution, which still could be a $300,000-a-year contribution for you, but your employee's age 20, who needs to replace a $20,000 income, you have 45 years to fund. You may have to put $2,000 in for them, and you pass non-discrimination forms of benefits, otherwise known as a section everybody should know before you walk out of my class, 401A4. The hardest section of the Internal Revenue Code, yet the most important thing that you will learn. Because if you can pass 401A4 independently, otherwise known as non-discrimination forms of benefits, you'll have a qualified plan. So anyway, you got to do that. Gives the employer a tax deduction. What are they looking for? I mean, it's the first thing I'll look at. Is it deductible? Why? Because if not, half of it, what I have goes to IRS and goes, in my case, the state of North Carolina, which we did reduce our tax rates from 7.75 to 5.85 recently. But still, I'm bleeding. Hello? And you say, well, put a tourniquet on you when you're age 70. That doesn't work. I'm bleeding now. And so that's the reason the qualified plans are heavy. Let's put it this way. There's a big demand for it, yet not a supply. Now, if you go back, I think in my case, 30 years, I was in the insurance business. Here was the problem. I was selling second to die. When I left that industry, put an illustration, I'd meet the client next week. They'd have 30 illustrations. I was going, now, this is competitive. Today in the pension business, at least this has been my experience for 17 years, you put a pension proposal in front of your client, guess what? There will be this counter proposals. None. No insurance company will show one. Nobody will come forth. Nothing. You will get zero competition, maybe 1 out of 100. I don't know if you experienced that. In yours, do you experience that? I haven't experienced competition in 17 years. You know, I hate your industry, because life insurance, I hate that. We sell a lot of life insurance, but I would never sell insurance if I can do a pension, because I don't have to compete. Now, here's what they will ask. How much do I have to give my employees? Remember, it's an employee benefit plan. They want to give the least amount, if possible, nothing, which you can't do. That's the biggest thing. And the other big thing you work at is the cash flow. Can they continue to make the contribution? That's it. So you're not going to be... No reason to pull an insurance illustration, worry about competition. Don't even have to worry about ratings. That's all irrelevant. It's how much do I have to give my employees, and can my cash flow support the annual contribution? That's it. And anybody who can, that has high W-2 income, is a candidate for this. Because personally, I don't like high W-2. Why? All I do is pay successively higher income tax brackets. I hate it. And more Social Security until I hit the cap of $120,000. And then I'm at what they call the taxable wage base. My Social Security taxes disappear. You know? So, and high income taxpayers will know it. Low income taxpayers will, I didn't know you don't have to pay Social Security once you go over $120,000. You think? So you give the employer a tax deduction. They like that. Allows the employee to exclude the employer contribution from income, which is one of the benefits of qualified plans to begin with. Deductible to the corporation, not included in the employee. This isn't rocket science, this is just great stuff. Yields a tax-free benefit to the employee at a critical time, death and or certain other benefits. The rules. Now the rules in ERISA are confusing and built to stay that way. I tell my graduate tax class this. Why? Because we don't want competition in this market space. So the rules are incredibly complicated, and if you want somebody to explain the rules to you, either A, they don't know, or B, they don't want to tell you. Unless you pay them, then they may tell you. I mean, that's just the way this is. And so we work at a very small club. Matter of fact, you know all the people, and there's only 15,000 people that work full-time in this industry that cover $20 trillion worth of assets. Seriously. Okay. It's not like insurance where there were 1 million agents, now we're down to 400,000, it keeps shrinking. You know, a qualified plan is a whole different space. All eligible employees must be included. Oh no, I gotta bring all the employees in. You wouldn't be surprised. No, read this word, eligible. So you should all know the basics. Not you, you don't get to talk because I know you know this stuff. But the rest of you, and you don't get to talk either. But we'll even pick on the A. Person's been there for 2 years and 2 months. Do you have to bring them in the plan? He has to work 1,000 hours, correct? And how many years does he have to be there before he becomes an eligible employee?
Depends on the plan.
Very good. Never answer the questions because there's always, it depends. It depends. If the plan document says there's a 2-year eligibility, you can just have somebody working there 1.5 years and they're not eligible. And you can do 2-year eligibilities in the plan. Or if they're, if you do a one-year eligibility, which we generally do, with a six-year graded vesting, they have to be there for at least a year or a year and a half because you use dual entry dates. And then they're in the plan, and then you have 6 years before they're vested, which means you make a contribution, but if they leave, you take it back. Too bad. It's employer contributions. So eligible employees are really good whether they have to be in a plan or not. Now here comes another interesting question dealing with affiliated service groups and common control. You have a person who owns 100% of company A, 50% of company B. Can he set up the plan in company A and exclude all the employees in company B? This is a great question. Is it a controlled group? Ding, ding, ding. This is not easy. If you think it's easy, you didn't do the research. It sounds like it, doesn't it? But have you read, it's not. Have you read Vogel Fertilizer versus Commissioner, sir? No, the U.S. Supreme Court case dealing directly with this issue and the research that was done by Darren Watson and other people. Here's the current status of that. You earn 100% of A, 50% of B. You have to earn more than 50% to have control. You only own 50%. Then you go check the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004, which I'm sure you all read, which there was a change in Section 1563 that changed the control groups for everything except retirement plans, where they still rely on Vogel Fertilizer. Then you read further to the PATH Act of 2015, which changed the control group again, but not for qualified plans, just for church plans. So we're still with Vogel Fertilizer, which means it's not a controlled group. But the thing is, this, like I say, ERISA, confusing and built to stay that way. So what you think is, oh, this is the way it works, you find out later on, no, it doesn't work that way, it works this way. And you have to go back, read, and understand this stuff. And for that reason, everybody's out there, we don't want to hear about it. You can't blame them. So eligible is, the plan cannot discriminate in favor of certain employees. Of course not, you know, except the permissible discrimination, which we already went over, and that's age and compensation. Related business must be aggregated together, but the question, how related are they? If I own 80% of company A, 80% of company B, is it a controlled group? 80% of A and I own 80% of B, is it controlled? And the answer is yes. I mean, that's a clear thing, clear controlled group, and you have to include employees of both companies. So depending the fact pattern you get depends on what you can or cannot do with it. Well, plan documents must be implemented and kept up to date. They all rely on plan documents. But if you read the code carefully, do you need a 412E3 plan? Does it have to have a plan document? Or will a custodial account do? Read it carefully and you'll see the code actually says it could be a plan, trust, or a custodial account. So you can actually have a fully insured defined benefit plan with a custodial account. Interesting. But I don't see anybody attempting that right now. Most of them have trust documents for other reasons. They don't want to test that area of the Internal Revenue Code. I can't blame them for that. Strict. Yes?
Are you going to talk about church plans?
No. Church plans are beyond the scope of this, other than that one thing with PATH, which we avoided. Other strict administrative requirements must be met. One is, of course, the filling out of the 5500 return every year. But here's the question to you. Are you in the insurance industry?
Yes.
Are you are you self-employed?
No.
You work for somebody. Are you in the insurance industry? Are you self-employed? Okay. Do you have any employees? Okay. You set up a plan for yourself and you decide to do a pension. You're going to purchase insurance and annuities inside the plan. You're going to avoid the Social Security and income taxes on the purchase of your insurance annuity contracts, and you're going to put in $50,000 because you just don't want to pay taxes on it. Now here's the question. Do you need to fill out a form 5500 to the IRS? And the answer is no. Remember, ERISA is complicated and built to stay that way. You should always say it depends. But the answer is no, because a single employer defined benefit plan, which is what you have, you don't fill out a 5500 until you have more than $250,000 in the plan. So you actually, what you would do is take the deduction on either line 17 or 23, depending if you follow S or C status, and you won't even fill out the 5500. Isn't that cute? It's called. And you have your pension plan, and you'll purchase the insurance and annuities from your favorite company, whichever it might be, assuming their policies qualify to be in a qualified plan, and not all of them do. In fact, most of them don't. You know, part of it is because the annuity is not unisex. Required of the Supreme Court case, Arizona versus Norse. But there are a lot of other requirements that have to, you have to, tax implications, all right? The employer contribution is all deductible. This is the big driver. Because in your wonderful 401k market, and they do a great job marketing their stuff, the 401k, which is tax inefficient relative to your pension, because remember, in your pension, you're not going to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes. But I want to do a solo K. Then you're going to pick up 15.3%. Good for you. Guess what? Our actuaries refused to let us do a 401k. And I said, and this was back in 2001, I was going, are you kidding me? Everybody has 401k. I said, go look at it real carefully. This is tax efficient. I looked at it, and they were right. So we didn't set up a 401k. We actually set up a plan with your company, by the way. I retired off it. Yeah, yeah. But they convinced me that 15.3% load. Are you kidding me? Nobody in their right mind would have a solo K, and nobody in their right mind, if they had to, unless you're an employee and you're forced to have it, would have a K plan. You're going to have an E plan. But you don't know, because how many took retirement planning classes here in high school? No one did. So they didn't even know. And what about our industry, the insurance industry? Do they train you in this? No. So what we have is a bunch of people that just don't even know the basic. And if you want to, you can research, you can fact check me afterwards to see if I'm right. No Social Security, Medicare taxes are taken out. And you save 15.3% every year. So in your case, you're going to put $50,000 away, deduct it. You're going to do it every year, 10 years, $500,000. 15.3% is going to be saved. How much are you going to save? You're going to save about $75,000 in Social Security and Medicare taxes because you went that direction as opposed to a 401k. That's it. You know, this is not rocket science, but very few people know about it for two reasons. A, it's not taught because they believe you don't want to know. And B, which we're experiencing, people don't want to know this. Can't blame them. Economic value. Okay, the economic value, of course, probably deals with the interpolated terminal reserve, aka the PS58 rates, that if you want the death benefit to go out tax-free, you pay. Income taxation of death benefit could come out tax-free if you reinclude the PS58 cost, but it's only to the net amount at risk. Remember, risk is confusing, built to stay that way. It'd be easy to say the death benefit goes out tax-free, but that's not true. Death benefit minus the cash value goes out tax-free. So as you build up cash value in your policy, unfortunately, more of it comes out taxable. We'll omit that. Now, is that misrepresentation on the new fiduciary rule, or should we explain that to every client?
But if you have a $5 million death benefit,
yeah, you get $4,750,000 out tax-free.
Right.
Yeah, the real problem with the $5 million death benefit, and this is just ours. If you read the Rev Proc 2000, 4-26, or whatever it came out, and they say that you can't have excess death benefits in the plan. And our real reading is that excess death benefits, you want to use the 100 times monthly earnings rule or the $3.4 million given by the GAO. So we cap our death benefits at 3.4 for this reason.
$3.4 million.
I cap the death benefits in our plan at 3.4 for this reason. Remember, maybe you don't remember, when you argue before the IRS, there's the rules, and then there's the way they think the rules are, and the way you can argue before a tax court. $3.4 million is the amount necessary. Yeah, you're still ahead of the game. No, I understand that. You still got a huge benefit. But I'm just saying that the reason we cap at 3.4 is if you had to argue before the service, it's excess benefit. You need $3.4 million to replace $215,000 a year. And I have the GAO accounting study to do that. If I had $5 million, then they'll say, what are you doing with the excess death benefit? And our answer will be an audit. How do I defend this again? And remember, I've gone through over a dozen audits with the IRS. I've done expert testimony in a half a dozen cases. So I've unfortunately been through the bramble bush. And I know that when you go to argue these things, you better have your ducks lined up. And then that duck, I haven't been able to see how that's going to hunt, which is one reason I stay away from and have stayed away from all the 419 plans because I say, I don't know how that duck hunts. And I stay away from restricted property trust because that duck is going right down the tubes with all the other 419s. Dead. Pardon? They should sell zero. I'm actually speaking in a conference in Florida to some people that sell. I'm saying, okay, if you guys are serious about this, here's what you do. You stop it. You will be sued. You will lose. And if you're lucky, you will not go to jail like Dan Carpenter and John Carrasco, who are right now sitting in Fed Pen. That's how bad it is. Or our friend, who's our friend and, gosh, the Zealand guy, David Guest. And I tried to get him off, but I mean, you're going to jail, buddy. You're in deep doo-doo. Don't go that direction, you know. And so, and I'm meeting with the guy there. I'll be face-to-face. I said, dude, you don't want to do this. You are going to lose. Done enough of that work. Forget it. Estate taxation death benefit will be included in the estate, but we now have the unified credit is $5,490,000, doubled because you get DCIA. Unless you have more than $11 million, who cares? And most of them don't. Economic advantage compared to other life insurance. Tax deductible. You know, sorry, Charlie, you can talk all you want to. Maybe to small employers who, people that work for companies that don't have large incomes, and they'll be willing to buy the non-deductible policies. But let me tell you, talk to any professional with a high income, you better be talking about a tax deduction for them. Otherwise, there's the door, my friend. You're out. You know, I'll go find someone who'll give me a tax deduction for my plan or my taxes. And that's the name of this game. Health insurance, forget that. Incidental benefit rules, the coverage rules, test for incidental benefits. Incidental benefit test. I'm going to go over that because I think that's next. It's confusing. Voluntary purchase, automatic provide. Straight, where's the death benefit combination? I don't want to go through that. Here it is. No. Oh, here it is, the incidental death benefits. Limits placed to the amount of insurance on a qualified retirement plan that can be purchased on the behalf of a participant. Let's say you don't want a pension plan. You want a profit-sharing plan. Oddly enough, you guys probably do a lot of them. Most of mine, they're all DBs, and they place the death benefit in the DB. But if somebody set up a 401k profit-sharing plan, can you buy life insurance on a profit-sharing plan? The answer is yes. But you have limitations, otherwise known as incidental benefit limitations. One of the limitations is that you can only purchase up to 50% if it's a whole life contract, 25% if it's a universal life contract, and take your termites and throw them in the trash can where they belong. And that's it. So you have what they call these limits. Now, if it's a DB plan, generally it's 100 times monthly earnings at normal retirement age. Okay, so you dig on further. Since he's in enrolled age, he digs further. I came across the 66 and two-thirds rule. Dun, 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 dun. Anyone hear of the 66 and two-thirds rule? Dun, 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 dun. You can purchase life insurance up to 66 and two-thirds of a theoretical contribution to the plan. Anyone hear of that? You haven't heard of the 66 and two-thirds? It's been around a long time. Okay, but let me tell you about the rule. 66 and two-thirds, as opposed to 50%, is not a rule. It is a letter, seriously, from Phoenix IRS to Phoenix Home Life that they approved that they could purchase up to 66 and two-thirds of the contribution to the profit sharing plan into the life insurance policy. Okay, I'm a tax attorney. I go to tax court, and I pull out the letter. Is that the law? A letter from the IRS to Phoenix Home Life? Sir, is that the law, Chris? It's not the law. That is correct. It's a letter. Can I rely on that in court? No. No. No, sir, not anymore. In the new Circular 230, here's the deal. You'll love it. You can't rely on anything your attorney says. You cannot rely on anything your CPA says or EA. The only thing you rely on, which is called substantial authority, is IRS rules and regulations and things promulgated by the service. Everything else is not substantial authority. They cut us like this. Yes, but in front of the tax court judge, here's what you'll love. The letter is not substantial authority. He can toss it. What about a revenue ruling? Remember, this is all based on revenue ruling 74307 for those who've read it, right? Is that the law? Very good. You got it right, Chris. It is not the law. All the revenue rulings you read are not the law. The IRS revenue rulings are IRS litigation positions. Now, generally, we do not take positions against the revenue rulings because they're so embedded in our history that it'll be very difficult to get a judge to throw it out. But can I, as a tax attorney, go in front of tax court and tell the tax court judge, this is a revenue ruling, let's toss it. Well, let's not look at it. I can. And some judges will toss it. You're right, litigation position. What else do you have on incidental benefit? And what's your argument, Mr. Palavan? I get to move on further. The IRS tries to convince you that the revenue rulings are the law, but then, yeah, people that know they aren't. And the tax court judge knows, and they aren't. But, you have to be very careful in front of the judge because they go, this has been around since 1974, Mr. Palavan, so what's your position why it's not an incidental benefit? And I go, okay, well, it has higher cash value in it. I haven't argued that yet. I don't intend to. I'm not going to argue against 74307. So, under defined benefit plan, the face amount of the insurance cannot exceed 100 times the participant's monthly retirement account. That is in revenue ruling 74307 for those who have read it. If you haven't, Google it and read it. What are we doing here? If you want to sell a lot of pensions, you better know at least about the pensions. This is assuming if you want to sell a lot of life insurance. Yeah, we have some producers that sell 250,000, a million of this per year. They know what they're doing, and they won't tell anybody how it's done, which I think is hilarious. But anyway, they have to know rules like this, and 100 times monthly earnings used to be 1,700,000, I think it was 17,500 per month when it was 210, which was last year, which translates to a death benefit of $1,750,000. That would be a safe harbor amount. But like I said, you could use other amounts. You don't necessarily have to do this rule. You can go to the 50-50 rule in contributions. There are several of these. Under defined contribution plan and or defined benefit plan, including 401k, life insurance can be purchased if it's less than 50% of the employer's contribution used to purchase whole life, which means, I don't know if you guys sell whole life. How many people do whole life? Please all raise your hand. Good. That's the only policy we use. And the only one the IRS approves. And the reason, and at least in the pension plan. And because they believe, remember they don't know what they're doing, but they do believe, they do, that it's the only one that provides sufficient guarantees. So take your UL and throw it in the trash can. They won't accept it. And frankly, they're right to a certain extent because your UL policies can vanish. Remember, the difference between a UL and a whole life is that you can change the amount and frequency of the premium payment and death benefits, which means technically you can tail it out and vanish it, which you can't do in a whole life. So you're selling whole life, UL, no. It's not even allowed in a qualified plan. Period. End of story. I'm in a pension plan. You can put it in a profit sharing plan. Yes, sir. Questions?
Even with a
I'm not the IRS, but this is how they think. Remember, I'm not the IRS. Okay. So even with a guaranteed no lapse rider, you guarantee whatever you want. The minute they see UL, they go, dun, 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 dun. I'm talking about in a pension plan, fully insured. Dun, 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 dun. Gone. Yeah, and you have too many, you as the participant has too many rights. Yes, sir, you have a question in the back.
There's no guarantee that they will continue to pay a whole life policy.
But the thing is, the assumption is they will pay the whole life to normal retirement age, and technically they have to. Do you know why? Because in a qualified plan, the plan sponsor has to guarantee the benefits to normal retirement age. And if they don't, two administrative agencies come down on their hammerhead and will take their company from them. One is called the Department of Labor, which we're all familiar with because of the fiduciary rule. I have to deal with these wonderful people all the time. There's the PBGC, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So when you set up a qualified plan to normal retirement age, you better fund it. And if not, and I had a couple companies that, well, we're just not going to fund it. The IRS swooped in and took their company. Department of Labor says, okay, we'll take your company then. You will see that happening more and more often, usually in what they call the multiple employer plans, because you have to, the rules are you have to fund it to normal retirement age and guarantee the benefits. In my other talk, we're going to have fully insured plans. Why we use fully insured plans, we do not use mutual funds and stocks. And one reason you can learn real simple. If you bought a fixed annuity for $100,000 you did every year for 10 years, can you tell me the guaranteed values in the fixed annuity 10 years from now? Can you? $100,000 a year for 10 years, can you do it? Yes, fixed annuity, you can, can't you? Of course. What about a whole life product? Can you tell me the guaranteed cash surrender value of the whole life product you funded over 10 years? Right, you can. And can you convert it to a lifetime income using the annuity purchase rates in the life and the annuity contract? You can, so everything's guaranteed. So we know what it's going to be at normal retirement age. Now you have the stock, Jack. I'm going to put it all in, what's my favorite stock? I bought Coke stock, but also I bought Fitbit. And I bought. Let's say I put in the stock market. Can I tell you what my guaranteed rate's going to be in 10 years from now? What's the theoretical guaranteed rate of my Fitbit stock 10 years from now? You're correct, it's zero. I lost everything. Do I get penalized as the plan sponsor? Or do I just lose the money? In a 401k, you just lost the money, right? Oh, you do get penalized. You're right. You get penalized 10% to 100% of the underfunding, which means I got to make up every dime and dollar. Seriously, pensions are different. We are not your father's 401k plan, my friend, or your brother's. This a pension plan is you go to retire, the benefits better be there. And if not, you pay a penalty. And we had one doctor group. They're a neurologist. I don't want to go over time. Anyway, the neurologist group, they had millions in their plan. They lost $250,000. Stock market went down. And they go, what happens? I said, well, you owe a penalty unless you make it up. Well, forget it. We're not going to do anything. They're neurologists. They're too busy. So I got a penalty from the IRS of $25,000. Ignored it. It's $25,000. Who cares? Then they got the next penalty because it's a two-tier penalty, $250,000. Let me tell you something. I got a phone call. Usually with doctors, like $25,000, what's the, let's go to the next case, right? They're making good money. $250,000 from the IRS, a demand letter of $250,000. Ring, then it hits my desk, boom. Mr. Palavia, what is this? I said, you lost money in the stock market, didn't you? Yeah, in our pension. I said, yes. The IRS doesn't like you losing money, so you got a $250,000 penalty. Which is one reason on small plans I do fully insured, not traditional, because small people don't even understand that the two-tiered penalty exists. Yes, sir, in the back.
Does the $250,000
Okay, it's a penalty, as in a fine. And here's what you do as a tax attorney like myself. I get on the phone and I cry to the IRS. I'm so sorry. They really didn't mean to do it. How can we settle this? And I got to settle it by putting the money back in the plan, and I got out with nothing.
So it's just a fine, they put it in as a contribution.
They put it in as a contribution, right, right. But see, they didn't, to get the attention of the doctor, okay, if you want to get the attention of a doctor, have the IRS send a $250,000 penalty to your doctor. And then the attention is got. Because really what they're trying to do, see, we work with the TEG, Division of the Internal Revenue Service, tax-exempt and government entities. What we're trying to do, what they're trying to do in the mission statement is to encourage people to set up qualified plans and have money to retire off of. So they're not encouraging people to disqualify the plans or have huge fines attached. So there are the rules, and then there are the unwritten rules. And the rule is, I'm dead. Okay. The unwritten rule is, if I'm nice to the IRS auditor, I could probably get this thing waived, and that's what we did. You know, so, and that's an unwritten rule. So there are the rules and the unwritten rules of the qualified plan area. Must report the, okay, we went over that, the table 2001 rate. Printed transaction exemptions, we'll skip that. Distribution life insurance surrender, pay the tax, purchase and transfer. That's at retirement. You know, it's very interesting, because when you go to retire, you'll have a lot of different options. And you have options throughout the year. A lot of people, especially your CPAs, don't understand that there's a lot of play inside the plan, even on an annual basis. One play, if you need to make adjustments, is salary adjustments. Because remember, it's based on your salary. If you up your salary, your pension contributions go up. Move your salary down, the pension contributions go down. Use a career average formula, it goes up and down at a lesser rate rather than end of the year formula. So it depends on salary. The other thing you can do is you can amend your plan and change your benefit formula. That'll change your contribution amount. We had to do all this in 2008. We're managing over 300 plans, and the stock market went down 37%, for those who remember it. I remember it. 300 plans, stock market down 37%. So we call all the insurance companies. How are we doing the annuity in the insurance market? What happened to our annuity insurance contracts? They went up 4%. Our clients were shocked. They were going like, what? How come your pension plans went up when the stock market went down? And you know this. The money's not tied to the market.
Yeah, but their capital is.
Their capital is. But we were the only ones that had do-re-mi when they were losing money. So we had to do a couple things. What are we going to do? Terminate the plan. Terminate and distribute, which will be a taxable event. Terminate, roll to an IRA, which is a non-taxable event. Take out as a lifetime income and avoid Section 72T. Or reduce the benefit formula, amend the plan, reduce benefit formulas and contributions going in. It was a mayhem. But the good news for the clients, the money was there because they were on life and annuity contracts. And we explain to those clients all the time, because remember right now, oh, the stock market's going up, we got to invest in stocks, which everybody does after the stock market goes up. Oh, the stock market went up, we've got to invest in stocks. Not realize, but, and most clients have gone through 2008 that have income. Don't you want to have a certain amount of money that's exempt from that? Yeah, how do we do that? The pension plan. But I still want to participate in the stock market. So here's the question to you. Can you set up a pension plan and a 401k plan and deduct both? And the answer is yeah. So I say put your gambling money in that 401k. Deduct that. And your serious money in the pension. Deduct it, but at least it's going to be there. And the 401k, invest in Fitbit like I did. Not a great stock. Actually, it's not, but I did Rite Aid. I thought Rite Aid was getting bought, and it didn't. I took that dive. I did Apollo Group, but I made money at it. But it's all goofy stuff. You know, it goes up and down, blah, blah, blah. So the thing is, that's what you do with your 401k money. It's in the marketplace. And why would you have a 401k if you have a pension? When I just railed that 401ks are tax inefficient. Why would you have a 401k and a pension? You can, but also you're above the taxable wage base. If you're making more than $120,000, you're already paid in Social Security, it disappears. Why not get the extra deduction in the 401k? The only thing you pick up is the extra Medicaid tax. Most of my clients are above the wage base, so they know that. So they're already paid into Social Security, so you might as well have the 401k and get the extra deduction. So we'll add a 401k feature. Now the next question. Can you have a profit-sharing plan and get more deductions? And the answer is yes, but of course it depends. Because there's a code section 404A7, which I'm sure you all read. I thought I spent my life in 404A7. It's a combined plan limitation. We're limited to 6% of your pay if you have a defined benefit plan and your pension plan is not covered by the PBGC. But if it's covered by the PBGC, you get the full 25%, which means you could have technically $54,000 in deductions in your 401k profit sharing plan and $300,000 in your pension plan, seriously, and deducted. But the pension has to be covered by the PBGC, and not all pensions are. Because there are certain pensions, especially if you are a professional service provider, doctor, lawyer, architect, engineer, enrolled agent, you might be a professional service provider, you're not covered by the PBGC unless you have more than 25 employees. Ding. So you're limited to 6% of pay. Where'd that rule come in? You can't find it in the code because it isn't. It's ERISA, section 4021, subsection 13. Then you find it. But you got to be able to find that rule, then you know where it is. Overall cost advantage compared with other methods of purchase. Tax advantage, deductible going in. Certain amounts could be tax-free going out. Yeah. Self-completion feature. A lot of the plans we have, the at normal retirement age, the insurance is paid up, and of course the annuities on an annual basis. And safety investment, big one, especially during the recession. The assets are safe from, we have the state insurance guarantee funds, which you can't talk about the client, but I can. State insurance guarantee funds, we also have the PBGC coverage, which is limited, but does provide a certain amount if you're a PBGC covered, and plus the safety of the insurance company as well, and the plan cost for the employer. Usually we'll have a level annual contribution to normal retirement age. Like I said, all your work in pensions is not the carrier. Sorry, they don't care. It's the employees, how much money do I have to pay my employees, and can my cash flow support the annual contribution to the plan? And so we always say, what's your budget? What can you comfortably set aside? We finished a case in Hawaii. They said we can put away $250,000 a year. They run some weird thing with Home Depot. I have so many clients, they do weird things. They make a lot of money. I don't even know what they do. You know, but their budget is $250,000. Okay, so we manage the $250,000 end of the plan. Then we reduce their salary to the lowest possible amount. Why do they want the low salary? They don't want to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes. Hello. You know, if somebody could get away with a $10,000 salary and put away $200,000, they'd do it every year. And that was the famous case, Walton versus Commissioner, which came out several years ago. It's one of my favorite tax court cases, I think from 2012, which I can give you if you want it. Administration costs, got to keep these burgers down too, which is us. We're a third-party administrator. They don't want to pay us. I haven't seen clients saying, oh yeah, you're a TPA, can't wait to write the check. Right, Brett? No, they don't want to write the check to TPAs. So you got to keep the cost down, which we can in fully insured, but not traditional, because we don't need a Schedule SB in a fully insured. Don't need those enrolled actuaries. Why don't we need a Schedule SB? Because we're running everything on the guaranteed rate of the insurance company. You need a 5500 SB if you do a stock, because you need an actuary to come in and say, I think the stock's going to go up 6%. It's going to go down. I'll do my valuation. And they charge $300 per hour to look at your stuff. Like, no kidding. That's the cheapest bid I ever got from an EA. You do a fully insured, you already did the calculation. You know the guarantee rates in 10 years from now. You can run it on your bloody computer. And in your case, you don't have to fill out the 5500. Not rocket science, but you got to keep the administration costs down, put more in retirement. Life insurance policies provide a lower return than alternative investments, but it's not an investment. You know, the minute I get these people say, well, it doesn't compare with an investment. I said, dude, it ain't an investment. It's life insurance. It's the same reason I own car insurance. Yeah, I die, my dear wife wants to pay the bills. That's the reason I have it. Would I want it? No. You know, but I'm not the driver. I have to go home every day. My wife goes, what happens if you die? You're out in Utah speaking. How am I going to pay the bills? So you carry the insurance. Not an investment, pay the bills. Yes. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, right. Usually what happens with the pencil pushers, they're looking at the cash value. And as I try to explain to them, okay, it's not the cash value, it's the death benefit. But we have some policies that return all the premiums at normal retirement age plus profit. Seriously. So we can design the policies today, which I couldn't 15, 20 years ago. Let's say you put, because our average contribution to a pension, you'll love this in life, $70,000 a year, life policy. That's our average contribution. Some are higher, some are lower. Average is 70 in life. Average annuity contribution, 130. Average contribution, 200. Which is one reason most of the people shouldn't be in our industry, because it's 200,000 a year going in. Every year, you got to be used to it. Okay, so let's look at that. 70,000 life goes in life. Commissions, pretty good. So the producer does quite well in spite of the fact you have to fill out now, what's that, form 8424, the PTA form. All right, now let's look at the return on investment for the client. 70,000, 10 years from now, they put in 700,000. Usually the cash surrender value is around 770. They get all their money back plus a profit. Some insurance companies let you do that. So what's the real net cost to the client? Now, listen again. You put in 70,000 a year for 10 years, 700,000. You surrender it 10 years from now, you get back 770,000. What's the cost of the insurance? We all know, because you guys are in the industry, it's the term cost. But what is the rate of return? Is it negative or positive? Let's look at the math again. 70,000 a year, 10 years, that's the premium. 10 years from now, you have 770,000 cash surrender value. These are high cash value policies. Is the return positive or negative on the life side?
Positive.
Positive, duh. It's not bad. So the thing is, when somebody says it's a bad investment, well, I just tell them you get your return of investment back, plus a little profit, and you got to carry the death benefit during the 10 years that you were subject to being at risk. Yes, sir. I have 1 minute. I'm just getting started. I actually have a lot more material, but I only have 1 minute to go through. So the thing is, what you find out in practice, I go, well, that makes sense. I've never seen any of those types of policies before, but they're out there, high cash value policy. The annuity, oh, I'm boring. Sorry about that. But it's guaranteed. And now this is a question that came to the Journal of Accountancy, which I wrote the article in 2009. And I said, you know, there's something funny about the annuity. No commissions come out of the annuity contract. Now, you'd think accountants, the General Accountancy would know that. All producers know. It's a fixed annuity. No, it doesn't come out. It's a long-term surrender charge. Which, who cares? Because I've done this. The average person in our office stays for 9 years and 10 years. Even when I try to get rid of them, they keep coming back. They're like flies. And you know that, okay? You don't like me as an administrator? Go find someone else. They go out in the outer space and they found, I can't find anybody. Duh. Okay, so the thing is, they come back. But anyway, the thing is, they don't take anything out of the client's account. It's not a variable annuity, which they usually knock out 5.85%. So the thing is, there's certain advantages in the market space that you have. And all I say is this the panacea for everybody? No. Is it a weapon that should be in your arsenal? Yes. Does our industry compete well with the 401k people? No. Do we have a competitive advantage? Yes. It's the Social Security and Medicare taxes. With that, I thank you very much for attending. Hope you enjoyed it. And make sure you go to Dave Gresham's presentation. He'll be here afterwards. Thank you.